Hallo und herzlich willkommen im Etablissement, dem kleinen Bühnenpodcast für die Dame, die ihr graues Haar in vielen Schnörkeln und Ausladungen trug, zu einer umständlichen und hochgebauten Coiffure angeordnet, in welcher irgendwo seitwärts eine große, farbig funkelnde und ihrerseits mit einem weißen Federbüschel gezierte Brillantagraffe befestigt war. Also wenn jemand wissen will, wie ich mir ungefähr das Etablissement-Publikum vorstelle, irgendwie so in der Art. Weiterhin befinde ich mich in Los Angeles. Heute wird das Thomas-Mann-Haus wieder eröffnet, das ja in den großen Bränden hier Schaden genommen hatte. Heute ist dazu noch Thomas Manns 150. Geburtstag, also ein schöner Zufall, die Eröffnung und der Geburtstag an einem Tag. Wir Fellows konnten mittlerweile hier einziehen und ich muss schon sagen, das Haus und der Ort hier hat schon eine ganz spezielle Aura und hier reinzukommen ist schon wirklich was Besonderes. Ich bin ja ziemlich viel rumgekommen in der Zeit, in der das Haus noch geschlossen war, habe viel Theater, Shows, Performance sehen können, aber es gab einen interessanten Moment letztens. Das Thomas-Mann-Haus war an einer Veranstaltung beteiligt an der UCLA zu Arnold Schönberg und Thomas Mann in Hollywood. Und dort wurden Klavierstücke von Schönberg gespielt. Und ich saß da und nach all dem amerikanischen Theater und Showbiz, das mir total gut gefallen hat, das ich liebe, das witzig war und toll, habe ich Schönberg gehört und dachte, oh, wie ein frischer Wind plötzlich. Da komme ich her. Ich mag sowas. Also 12-Ton-Musik, keine Botschaft, keine runde Dramaturgie, kein gutes Ende. Man hört sich diese Stücke an und weiß gar nicht so recht, wo befindet man sich gerade so innerhalb dieser musikalischen Struktur. Es hat mich irgendwie diese Kunst, die bei uns irgendwie noch, ich sag mal noch, radikal sein darf, man weiß ja nicht, was da so passiert, also die Wagnisse eingehen kann, irgendwie nochmal ganz anders sehen lassen, hören lassen. Also diesen Wert zu sehen von etwas, das nicht verkauft werden muss nach all dem Showbiz. Denn das, was ich hier sehe, unterliegt natürlich immer auch diesem Zwang so. Es müssen die Sitze gefüllt werden. Es war irgendwie ein spannender Moment. Das macht die Kunst natürlich auch zugänglicher, so dieses Verkaufen müssen, populärer. Das bringt viele tolle Dinge hervor. Aber als ich so Schönberg hörte, dachte ich schon so, not bad. Okay, weiter im Text, zurück zum Showbusiness. Los Angeles ist, das habe ich ja in der letzten Episode schon so ein bisschen geschildert, eine Comedy-Stadt, überall kleinere und größere Comedy-Clubs und ganz unterschiedliche PerformerInnen, die versuchen, hier entdeckt zu werden oder den Durchbruch zu schaffen. Stand-up hat in den USA natürlich eine ziemlich lange Tradition, deswegen gibt es hier auch mittlerweile Leute, die das Genre sehr ausweiten, viel experimenteller damit umgehen. In New York war ich zum Beispiel bei Stamptown, so eine Art wildem Varieté-Abend, der wirklich so alle Grenzen der Korrektheit sprengte, von dem, was man denkt, was so sagbar sein könnte, gemischt aus Musik, Zirkus, Clownerie, Stand-up. Da gab es zum Beispiel ein Stand-up-Set, das nur aus Lauten bestand, also es gab gar keine Worte. Das geht dann ja schon fast so Richtung Sprachkunst, Klangkunst und das war wirklich faszinierend. In L.A. war ich zum Beispiel bei einer Show in einem Theater Dynasty Typewriter, wo es auch an dem Abend mehrere Comics gab, eine davon Lizzie Cooperman, die erstmal ein Keyboard auf die Bühne schleppte, das mit Fransen umklebt war und ich dachte, was passiert denn jetzt? Singt sie jetzt? Was kommt? Und sie hat dann ihr ganzes Stand-Up-Set quasi mit diesem Synthesizer, neben dem sie stand, untermalt, akzentuiert, Töne auf dem Keyboard dazu gespielt oder drauf eingedroschen, also wenn man will, so clusterartige Sounds, was diese ganzen Stories aus ihrem Leben, die sie erzählt hat, in so wilde Horror-Stories hat kippen lassen. Also irgendwie auch hier so eine Art von Musikalisierung. Also es war nicht wirklich eine schöne Musik, die sie dazu gespielt hat, sondern sie hat wirklich wie wild darauf rumgehämmert teilweise. Und Comedy ist ja eh so rhythmisch und damit nah an irgendwie so eine Art von Komposition, also Jokes und Punchlines, die einen Rhythmus haben und auch dann nur gut funktionieren. Also ich hatte sowas noch nie gesehen und fand das ganz toll und habe Lizzie Cooperman hinterher für ein Interview getroffen. Das, glaube ich, einen spannenden Einblick gibt darin, wie Stand-Up hier in Los Angeles gemacht wird, wie sie persönlich ihren Stil entwickelt hat, wie sie auf diese Idee kam, wie das entstanden ist und wie es sich als Comedian in L.A. so lebt. Also Happy Birthday Thomas und viel Spaß beim Gespräch mit Lizzie Cooperman. I'm a stage director and I'm now here to like meet different people
right.
who work on entertaining stage stuff. Let's put it that way. Because in Germany we have this quite strong separation between like arts and entertainment.
Interesting. Okay. So, I kind of wish it were more like that, actually.
Like that in America?
Well, I mean, not entirely, but sometimes it feels like people are driving toward commercial fame. I guess that might be more of a Los Angeles than a New York.
I can see the point. Also seeing your set.
Yes. It's not very commercial.
No, it is not. And that's why I was drawn to like talking right. to you, because I was like, oh, that's interesting. It had some kind of I don't want to say German vibe.
Did it really?
European vibe, where you think like you came out with this keyboard and I was like, what the fuck is happening now?
Right.
What is she doing? Because I saw stand up and just bringing this instrument was like something
I hadn't
seen before.
Okay.
And then this like how you turned like daily life into some kind of like a horror movie, or what is it like you are doing? That I'm like, this
I love that
German theater somehow.
Interpretation.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
Because I don't really know what I'm doing.
Oh, that's interesting.
There's no real intention. I have an idea, but it comes more from a way that I'm feeling or what I want to express rather than I want it to seem like this, you know?
Yeah. But that's also very, what I've seen so far, not very American. Mm. No?
Like, yeah,
because usually
you're right.
In American theater, people really like to see... Oh, we know this.
Yes.
It's this kind of format.
Yes.
It's like it moves around outside
yes.
of those boundaries.
They're outlining, they're planning, they're making sure it's, you know, no flyaway strands,
yeah.
that everything's contained.
Yeah. And they are confused if it's like
yes.
outside of those.
Yes.
Like, how did you develop this kind of comedy? How did you come to comedy?
Well, before I did stand up, I was doing what I'll call performance art. But I mean, I was like in my 20s doing performance pieces. I actually studied theater in college and had a minor in creative writing. And I tried to get a major called poetry in performance, which was rejected by an entire board of professors. I don't know why, but they said, we think you can still do that with a theater major and a creative writing minor. But I was doing performances like in large boxes involving large like refrigerator boxes. And I really loved that. I felt like I had just kind of tapped into something for myself. I guess in high school, I was also performing poetry in kind of an unconventional way. Like we had these speech contests at school where you could pick a category and then compete in that event. Do they have that in Germany?
No, okay. We don't have this. Like, we also don't have the spelling bee or something. Like,
right.
Like competition-based stuff we don't have.
I actually love that. That in my school, we had something called mock trial where we would have to pretend to be the prosecutor in a trial and then play all the roles, like a witness, the defendant. And we would kind of take turns pretending we were in court for some reason. Something everyone avoids as an adult.
But you tried to do this like in some kind of like poetic way, or you did it like with poetry.
So that was a separate thing, the mock trial thing. But we had a category called creative expression in this competitive speech program. So I would create these kind of collages of poetry. And then I would come out and perform the poetry, but, you know, standing on chairs, lying on the ground. This was with the help of, you know, my coach, who I think just had a sense of where I wanted to go with it and kind of guided me along and thought, oh, maybe it would be interesting if you did this and that. And it kind of broke things apart for me. And I started to kind of see things in a different way of that you can piece together. Things together really however you want to. And I started to kind of enjoy kind of the tension of mixing disparate elements. So I did performance art for a little bit in school. So I did this stuff in boxes. I did this piece called Poetry Machine after college, where I would just ask like a coffee shop, can I kind of be stationed somewhere in your... in your establishment, in this box.
You were standing in this box.
Yeah. I was just waiting inside a box, but it was a jukebox. and it was called a poetry jukebox. So people would come in and put in a quarter, and then I would pop out. My head would pop out and my arms, and I would read a poem. First, I would play Vivaldi's Four Seasons, and it said hello in all these different languages. And then I would be like, and thank you for inserting the coin. And then I would pop out, do the poem, and then go back in.
A self-written poem.
Yes.
Okay. What kind of poetry did you write?
Well, I actually still write poetry. Pretty dark, I think.
Okay.
But I wouldn't say a goth. I was really influenced by this poet, Marge Piercy, when I was young. And I loved Margaret Atwood as well.
Yes. As one does.
Yes. And I actually love Margaret Atwood's poetry. And someone gave me a cassette tape of her poetry and I memorized it. So it was kind of like in my body. It was almost like I felt like an apprentice or something with what I was writing then, as you kind of do as you're developing.
Yeah.
But I had some dark things happening in high school too. I grew up in a really chaotic home. I had a poem about, you know, my friend getting an abortion that was very, it was called Purple Afterthought. And that, I think, kind of maybe shocked the high school speech judges. I think I didn't understand that there was even controversy around it. I thought it was just, oh my God, this is something that my friend had to go through and that she was having this crisis around that I wrote about.
Yeah.
I mean, it started out and she has 30 minutes to tell me about two abortions. You don't know the color purple like I do, she said, as her cranberry mittens turned us. They turned us into the grocery store a lot. And it was kind of, and then there were three kind of lines at the end that kind of, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, super interesting.
Oh, you're too kind. You're like, I'd love to read your old abortion poetry. Be careful what you wish for. Like, how much time do you have?
How many abortions? Okay.
Yeah.
That in a coffee shop.
So I would perform stuff like that. So that was just one piece that I did. And then I tried doing a solo show. So the thing is, after college, I got accepted to this school in France. Have you heard of L'École Internationale du Théâtre Jacques Lecoq?
Of course.
I would assume so. As a scholar. Tell me everything. Well, I didn't go because I couldn't. Exactly. Johannes miming. So I couldn't afford to go. So I got in after college and I couldn't afford to go. And, but I had really seen myself kind of moving in that direction and becoming kind of a master of like movement. And I just saw that like it's synergizing.
Sorry.
Please do. Yeah. Tell me why. Like, no, what,
I don't know.
What is it like when I say master of movement?
Imagined you moving.
Just moving, like
the kind of movement. Yes.
Walking toe heel, of course.
Yes.
Of course, when I'm doing Shakespeare, I'll walk toe heel. In flats, yes. Maybe even barefoot. Who knows?
Risque.
Risque, exactly.
Going full.
And she wore no shoes. And so I couldn't afford to go. And I had insurance at the time. And I went and saw a therapist who was... I say that because I feel like my experience with therapy has always depended on how I'm doing financially, you know?
The French therapist.
No, but I didn't go to France.
Okay.
Because I couldn't afford to. So this therapist said, if you don't go to France, do something else that's going to feel like an adventure here. And I was living in Minnesota at the time. So I put together this solo show and I was so out of my depth. I had no director. I wrote this show about a narcoleptic maid who is never going to get to France. It was like this fever dream, basically, of what I was going through.
I see.
And I kind of added the narcolepsy. Wait, narcolepsy is falling asleep, right? Yes. For a second, I thought I said necrophiliac. I think everyone has that fear when they say narcolepsy.
No. Yeah,
like, I want to make sure. Okay. So I put together this solo show, and I had a video element that was me kind of asleep in this bathtub in this graduation gown. And I had someone create this that was going to be playing on a screen behind me. And my boyfriend at the time was supposed to bring this tape that we were going to play in the background. And afterward, everyone kind of clapped, like, that was so weird when I came out. I mean, it was a very small audience. It was like, I had just moved back to Minnesota. I don't think I really told, I don't know how well I publicized it. But, and afterward, I was talking to people and someone said, so why Dirty Dancing? And I said, what do you mean? And they said, you played the movie Dirty Dancing behind you. He brought the wrong tape. And so this film that I had made instead was Dirty Dancing. And it in no way related. And it was probably just people thinking, like, I can't even piece this together. Like, I wouldn't, which I don't blame them.
They probably thought it's like, in Germany, we would have thought, like, that's deep.
Okay. You know, that's, I should have done it there. What? I mean, I was in the Midwest.
What does the artist want to do?
Right. All right.
Okay.
So I think that I felt defeated. Like, I thought, oh my gosh, I had this vision of myself. I tried to take this risk. It didn't work out. Then I did another solo show after that that I really loved that came together. It was a piece of theater, but it had interesting characters. It was funny, I thought. In parts, but ultimately, anyway, who cares? So I did another one that was I liked.
What was the title of this?
That the next one was called Stew Art. It was a look at perfectionism in American culture, but through a very loosely based version of Martha Stewart.
I love that.
It was so fun. And I had in the backdrop a list of things that I had to accomplish during the course of the show. And there was one thing she just couldn't do because she couldn't open herself to do it. And
did you also bake in this show? Or
no, I didn't bake.
Okay.
I didn't bake. I'm trying to remember what I did. I can't remember everything. I mean, it was so long ago. Yeah. I know I made a picture frame out of a hanger. So then I did The Artist's Way. Have you heard of The Artist's Way?
Yes.
This book?
I've never did it, but I heard about it.
Would you do it? What's your impression of The Artist's Way? And you can put it down if you'd like to.
I just know that it's like like some kind of course, or they tell you like daily, yeah, you do a thing like to get your creative like juices.
Yes. And not that flowing. I was expecting you to put it down. It's just, I sometimes see people or I hear people go, yeah, everyone says to do The Artist's Way or whatever, like kind of with an eye roll. Yeah.
Yeah.
But that book was completely transformative for me.
Yeah.
So I think I was feeling really blocked. I was in Minnesota where I grew up, and I was just thinking, like, how am I going to make this happen for myself? How am I going to create a life where I'm enjoying what I'm doing and I'm not, you know, whipping myself to death when it doesn't go well? I'm
comedy
not.
Comedy seems like the perfect fit. No risk at all. Like,
well, she encourages you through gentle, small, you start taking small risks in the beginning of the book, and they kind of increase become a little bit more bold as you go on. It's like, it's actually structured after a 12-step program, after AA. So it's like a recovery for people who feel blocked or don't let themselves create or self-critical, or maybe you have someone's voice in your head who's like, yeah, don't do that. I mean, I had a lot of that, I think, growing up. Mm-hmm. I think I maybe did this old joke the night that you were there. When I told my mom I wanted to be a comedian, I was in high school, and she said, women who are comedians are fat and depressed. She said, and I just thought, okay, then I won't do it. You know, like, I just wrote it off. She's right. No, well, that's kind of in the joke I go, which makes me think my mom has been doing stand-up comedy. I think I maybe slipped that in. I don't know if I can't remember.
Yes, you said that.
Because that night, I was trying to get some older material on tape because I don't have a lot of visual representation, which I did get a recording of my set from that night.
Oh, it was so fun.
Oh, thank you.
But then again, when you said like you told your mom early on you wanted to be in comedy, it's not like you did art or poetry and then transitioned somehow to comedy, but the comedy was first.
I kind of grew up like when I was little, I did characters all the time. Like my grandma loved it, but others were annoyed. Like I was very too much energy. You're all over the place. Like you can't be controlled. And I was kind of like that. All my report cards said talks too much, disorganized, which is still the case, which is why I asked to do this here. I'm a flurry of like papers. I just don't, I'm trying to become more structured, but I say that and it just doesn't happen.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
Wow. It's my wiring.
Yeah.
There's fault. Irregular wiring. Yeah, I'm not going to say faulty. Thank you. Yeah. Are you organized?
I try to be, but I'm not.
Oh, really?
Yeah, which makes it even harder. I pretend to be organized. You seem to really enjoy it, or you maybe like you are like at peace with it.
I feel like I've learned to kind of move into it instead of away from it. Because I've also found, because I use notes a lot on stage, mm-hmm. which some people frown upon, but I can't remember. I need some kind of idea of where, because I don't do things really in a specific order.
Mm-hmm.
I've tried. I guess I could.
Yeah.
I have a general sense, you know, but I don't really know what I'm...
Of what order
I did
is.
Some new stuff that night, too, that I had never done before.
What was it?
I said something about my dermatologist. I said, should I get filler? And she goes, it's too late. And then I tried to create like kind of a fantastical... I need to work on that a little bit more because I just thought it was like she made me feel like I was in some epic fantasy novel. Like, it's too late. Like the wind starts blowing and like castles start crumbling around us.
You're old.
Yeah, you're old. It's too late. So I did... I can't remember
the early comedy.
Oh, yeah. So
comedy,
then...
Chaotic
so
characters.
So I started doing stand-up because I... had wanted to, but I felt like it was a U-turn in my life. Mm-hmm. I had called once about a comedy class and I didn't like how the guy sounded over the phone, so I just didn't take it. And I thought I should just sign up for a class. And
how old were you then?
24 or something. Oh, no, older. 29 maybe.
You already did the poetry and the art stuff.
Yes, I was already...
And then you said, I take a comedy class.
Yes, okay. So I took this class. It was very interesting. The first exercise was it was in a Best Western hotel room, like in kind of a smaller town in Minnesota. It was really an interesting group of people, you know?
Imagine.
I feel like I'm saying like Best Western and in my mind I'm like... Don't expect Johan to know what a Best Western
is. Of course I
know. But you know Best Western,
yes,
okay.
Of course. And I can imagine like the room you've been in, like a conference room or something.
Yeah, it was like a little bar. It was a bar.
It was a bar, okay.
Yeah, we met in the bar.
Okay.
And we would go up one by, it was like a carpeted, you know, like dark green, like a little pub.
Yeah.
Give you some lingo you understand. It was a beer garden.
Prost.
Exactly. And so we went up one by one and we were supposed to tell each other what we saw when we looked at each other. So not say anything. You would just go stand there and people would go, I think Johan's a dentist or whatever without it. And mine, they were very on the fence about
what you are,
what I was, I noticed. Whereas everyone else had something very specific. Some people thought I was a librarian. Some thought I worked in a nightclub. You know, they all had different ideas. So I didn't get a lot out of that exercise, but I loved watching it because it gave a lot of people like it's very kind of comedy 101 to start with how you look. Say like. The classic joke is like, I know what you're thinking. And then you make a joke about your appearance. So that's kind of where I think he was trying to get us started with some stuff that we could say off the bat when we got on stage.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. But it made me think this feels like has so much to do with identity. And I thought that was really interesting and how your act changes as you change. So I started doing stand-up, but I started doing it in a really way more conventional way.
Then you do it now.
Yeah.
Okay.
I learned how to write jokes. I had an act and I started very quickly after taking that class, probably a month or two after featuring or going on the road and opening for people in small towns. There were a couple.
So it was the classic like bar stool, water bottle.
Yes.
Standing.
Yes.
Yeah.
You know, my material was about like my boyfriend and guys or I'm not saying it was this. I mean, it was where I was, you know, being broke and all this stuff. So that was kind of where I started. And I did that for many, many years. And I actually had more commercial success with that. Okay. I got to do a late night set. You know, I got to like tour more. I felt like it was just more accessible. And I had kind of a breakdown because I got called in to be on this TV show on MTV where they, you know, those shows that they play a clip and then the person responds like and makes a joke about the clip. Do they have that?
Be like a talking head. Like,
yeah, it was a talking head. Like
old videos or something.
Yeah.
It's like comment on it.
Exactly. Like someone wipes out on a skateboard and you say something funny about it, you know? So they brought me in for one of those. And this was a huge turning point where I thought, this just doesn't feel like me. Like, I just felt like I wasn't using my, I don't want to say like my great potential, but it just felt like I was faking it or like I was pulling something off. Mm-hmm. Like, I felt like I liked my jokes, but I couldn't figure out where I was in it. You know, I couldn't figure out. And I also felt like I was writing jokes that were less just set at punchline and more like worlds. And I also had a manager at the time who I did this set that I loved with jokes that I still really like. And I brought it in to her and she paused it and was like, this is not stand up. And I was shocked because I was going to submit it for another late night appearance. And she basically was saying like, I want the old you. Mm-hmm. I want the girl.
And the boyfriend stories.
Not the woman. We want the old Britney.
Women's stories matter.
Exactly. Women's stories matter. But I did feel like she wanted me to be, which is fine. She signed me as my to represent
as
that
old self.
Self. Yeah. Then that material and that persona. And I started to grow out of it. And then I did this talking head thing. And you have to bring in jokes. So they'll show you a clip, the clips beforehand, and then you at home write jokes. And then you come in and they tape you doing the jokes.
Yeah.
So I did all my jokes. And then at the end, they said, can you just do one more and just go, uh-oh, SpaghettiO, after someone like fell on a skateboard? Or maybe it was like Taste the Rainbow. It was something that was in a commercial, like a line from a commercial. And I was like, you know, in my mind thinking, I don't really think that's funny, but I'll say it because I was also wanting to please them. And yeah, I wanted them to obviously ask me back. So then the show aired and that was the one line they used was me being like, uh-oh, SpaghettiO. And I just thought, how did I end up here? How am I? It just felt so far away from where I'd start my creative core. I don't even mean where I've started, but just who I am. And I had a show. I had some show that week. And I remember sitting in my car and thinking, I can't do this the way I'm doing it. And I went to a music store and I bought a piano. And I brought it to my show. And the first time I used it, I wasn't using it in the same way I am now. I just was using pre-recorded songs. Like I actually, speaking of Britney Spears, I told a story about meeting Britney Spears and I told it to like some public domain song that just played on my laptop or on my keyboard. And afterward, I thought, oh my God, I feel like I cracked something open for myself.
So did you really meet Britney Spears?
Yes.
Okay.
I worked. Are you a fan?
Yeah, of course. Who's not?
I mean, that's so funny. Yeah, I worked in a store on Melrose Avenue in West Hollywood called Diane von Furstenberg. Are you familiar with DVF?
Yeah.
And I worked in her store when I first lived here, and we got a call and they said, close all, draw the, curtains, kick everyone out. A celebrity's coming in. So we had to tell everybody, get out of the store. I'm so sorry. And I was helping this woman who looked like she was going to buy a ton of stuff. And I said, I'm so sorry, but I have to put the stuff on hold. She goes, I won't say anything to the celebrity. I'll mind my own business. My boss said, it's fine. Let Andrea or whatever her name is shop. We close the store. The celebrity comes in. And this is right after Britney's nervous breakdown, by the way. Maybe a month after or something like that. And I can see my woman staring. Peeking her head out of the curtain, staring at Britney Spears. And I'm like, what are you doing? I go, okay, let's go back. I was still trying to be polite. But then Britney comes to the register. Finally, she's done shopping. She pays. My woman comes out and she goes, I just wanted to tell you, you look very well. I was so mad. And then she went back in her room and I go, you said you wouldn't say anything. She goes, I just wanted to say something nice to her. And in my mind, I thought, because you want to go back to your country club and tell your friends. And I met Britney Spears. I gave her my
life advice.
Yeah, my life advice. Yeah. Straight from the desk of Andrea. I told,
Okay, so that's a story you used.
It was one, yes. I can't remember exactly. I talked about that job. Mm-hmm. I talked about, yeah. And so I think I did material as well. And then I just started bringing it to shows. And people were not on board because they knew me a certain way. And I think they saw it as like a hook or a crutch or something. And I just had to kind of ignore them. They would be like, oh, you're bringing you got your keyboard again,
And it's interesting. You have this interesting way of playing the keyboard. It's like almost like you are hating the keyboard or you're just hitting on the keyboard or something. I don't know.
Did you say hating?
Hate it. Yes.
Like I hate the keyboard.
Yeah.
That's so funny.
You're not talking to the audience and with the other hand, just like, it sounds so amazing. So it's perfect. I love it. Maybe I was also drawn to this whole thing because I work in music theater.
Yeah.
And it was almost it was some kind of like composition or something because then again, comedy is so much about like rhythm.
Yes.
And then you have this instrument added to that.
Yes.
Which I found super fascinating to watch and hear, I have to say.
That's so nice. I love hearing that because sometimes when I'm setting up and the booker of a show doesn't know me, they think I'm going to be playing parody songs or something.
Yes. You came out with the thing and I thought like, oh, she's going to stand there and be like,
yeah,
Strangers in the Night, whatever she's going to do. But I didn't
Strangers in the Night.
But I didn't expect like what happened next. So yeah, so they don't know what to do with that or with you.
Well, afterward, I think they're surprised.
Yes,
and sometimes pleasantly. But it's a challenging thing for me to market. Like if I'm doing a headlining show or something, I'm coming to town. How to explain to people, like, oh, you see a picture of a woman with a piano, you're going to make some assumptions. Mm-hmm. Yes. So I'm still figuring it out I need to become more active, like online and with posting and stuff like that, which I dread doing that because I feel like it's a live experience.
Can you describe a little bit like your style or what are you doing on stage? Is it possible? Is it even possible? But you said like hard for you to describe even for a flyer or something.
You know what's so funny? I was just talking to my friend about this because you have to write a description of I have an album and I had to write a description of it. And my friends and I wrote a description that was we tried to put every cliche in there possible. Mm-hmm. To make it funny, like just loaded it up with like, she'll she'll take you through the kitchen of intimacy to the smolding fireplace of satire. Like, but I can't see outside of myself.
Okay.
I don't see myself. And actually, a lot of times when I do, I don't. It's hard for me to watch. It's hard for me to see because I'm coming from the point of view of I just need to do this.
Mm-hmm. You don't want to think about it.
So right. Basically. I don't want to think about it. Like I want to, I have, if you saw my notes, they're crazy. It's a mess. I try to make order of it the best I can and try to communicate it. And then.
So if you are going out for one of those sets, you don't know exactly what you are going to
right.
do?
Yeah.
Oh, you know.
I could show you like a picture or something of one of my set lists.
Oh, yes, please.
Keep this part as I'm rummaging. Yeah. I loved the part when she went through her bag.
Amazing. Yes. Best.
It'll take me a second. But usually, actually what I do is before I go on, I think of the first like three things mm-hmm. that I want to mm-hmm. say because it'll probably be addressing mm-hmm. something in the moment. Mm-hmm. Which is a lot of comedians do that. But like at that show, we all make fun of the band. Oh, yeah. That night, I think I said something about how depressed the band was or something.
So you know, like the first moments and then you go with the flow.
Yeah, I don't
isn't
think.
Isn't it frightening? I said, isn't it frightening?
Yeah. And that never goes away.
Okay.
Like I always thought that would go away. It's never gone away for me. I mean, if I'm tired... Mm-hmm. It goes away a little. Mm-hmm. I cannot swim before I perform.
Like basically, you cannot move.
I can't swim.
The movements.
If I swim in water, I have no energy at night. I've had that experience like three times where I've been in a city where people go, we'll go to the river during the day and then we'll have you back for the show. And I just have no personality.
but that's the after swim feeling, you know. Every time I go to the swim, I get too much.
You
sun,
have that I'm too, then, yeah. Like, it's the sun too.
There's something, yeah. I know I'm empty or something. It's a nice feeling, but
I feel like if I have a show that I care about, because there are a lot of shows where it's like, well, you're performing to five people in a laundromat. It's not really make or break. Much respect to the laundromats across Los Angeles, but if I have to do a show, you know, where people are paying to see me or something, I'm doing them a real disservice by spending the day in the sun.
Yeah.
It really zaps me. I'm the same way.
Yeah. But you, if you're doing like a whole hour or your full thing,
yeah.
you have some kind of script. Or you also do the same thing. You have like the first few moments and then you riff.
Well, it's changed over time. I used to get nervous that I didn't have enough.
Okay.
Because before you do an hour, you go, I don't know what I'm going to do. Because you also, as you're writing and putting your set together, you start to get rid of jokes. Mm-hmm. Things that aren't as funny as the rest. Mm-hmm. So as you move forward, it's like sometimes I go, oh, I'm never going to get past this 10 minutes. Which is why I like to have centerpieces. This is what I realized. Mm-hmm. My album, I had like two or three big characters mm-hmm. that... I could kind of go back, kept going back to and kind of weaving in and out of where I felt like, okay, these are chunks. But especially if you're a one-liner comedian, it takes forever to build an hour.
Oh, yeah.
If you want actual strong jokes, and that's why it's such a shame, this need to be constantly generating material, which, I mean, a lot of... No, it's like TikTok stars are getting paid to do specials and stuff like that.
Yeah.
As my eyes just drift into the distance. Sadly. Or can I? Or just like, you know, like internet personalities, which is a lot of them are funny, so it's fine. But sometimes what happens to those people is they gain an online following, but they don't have the material to do an hour, and then they have to go headline, and then people go see those shows and go, oh, comedy's not that fun, you know? And it kind of, now I'm not on the road right now, but people are saying like sales are down by like 20% or something right now. Like people aren't really going out to clubs.
Is your album out yet, or is it coming?
I put it out in 2018, and now I'm going to do another one this year.
Okay, you have a title already?
I think I do, but I'm not sure yet. My last one is called Organism, because of the organ.
Yes.
Did you catch that?
Yes.
Some people haven't. And then other people said, it's called orgasm, right? I'm like, no, it's organism.
Okay.
So that was my first album. Yeah. And I'm still trying to get some video of some of those jokes.
Okay.
It just takes forever also to get high quality video. And it's such a racket, I'm telling you. Social media has just completely changed mm-hmm. the landscape for performers. Mm-hmm. And even like the video I got from the night that you saw me, I'm watching it going, this is, I look so big. I'm physical. I don't mean fat, although there were some unflattering angles. I mean, I over gesticulate. I'm expressive. I'm a stage person. I'm not a film person.
No. Yes. Yes.
And so
it's larger than life.
And it is not for a clip, but I have to start putting the clips out. There was one time I posted some stuff on TikTok and people were like, make it stop. Go away. Like, it's been positive except for one joke, which I didn't do. That's very kind of crazy that I was like, let's see how this does. And I was like, maybe I need to post a different version of this or something that's more palpable for Gen Z. Get ready with me. No.
A day in the life.
Yeah, a day in the life.
Everything I eat in a day.
Yeah.
I don't want to see.
That's so funny.
I mean, I try to watch a lot of comedy in LA. So comedy is...
Yes.
LA is like a super comedy. It's a comedy
town,
no? Yes,
absolutely. Yes.
I was in New York before, which is a total like theater town or performance, musical, whatever town.
Yes.
But LA seems like a comedy kind of town.
That's
how
really...
do you survive as a comic in LA? How do you do it? How do you work? How and why? Yes.
That's a good question. Do you mean how do I... Like,
it seems so like there's so many possibilities, or maybe also like so many people doing it, and it's so, the city is so expensive, and it's like a crazy city, and you drive everywhere.
I know.
Hours. Like, how? Why?
You kind of, I mean, I now am at a point where I feel like I don't have to chase as much as I, you know, maybe would have to if I were newer here or something, but I feel like I know enough people that I have kind of like laid a groundwork or I have a foundation. I have places that I feel like I can perform and people get it and they like me.
What are those places?
That theater, Dynasty Typewriter, is one of my favorite. There's another theater called The Elysian that's great. There's one called The Lyric Hyperion. The people there are lovely. And so there are a lot of theaters. There are also really great shows happening in more unconventional spaces.
What for example? Because I'm super interested in those places as well.
Some of the best shows are... I performed in a... There have been two great shows in hair salons.
You have to tell
One
me,
was at a salon called American Barber. I don't know if it's still... It was called Fresh Hair. And
it's like those punny hairdresser names.
Which took me forever to even get that hair was in there. I was just like, I'm doing fresh hair. They're like, hair.
Fresh hair.
And then there's one in Santa Monica called Bangs. I don't know if these shows are still going, actually, but performing in a hair salon, a lot of great backyard shows in the summer. And some of those are just packed. And then there's also a music venue. You know what you would love is Weirdo Night. Are you familiar? That's a great show that I think Dynasty Handbag is still doing at Zebulon, I think. But I really love doing Weirdo Night. And then there's a place in, what I call that? Santa Monica. It's called The Crow, which is a really nice, has kind of like a community feeling. It's in this string of museums, kind of. Galleries that there is this comedy club.
I really think that the comedy scene is much more diverse here than
now. There's a big club scene too. Yeah. So I don't really do the clubs as much. I used to do the improv with the old booker. The improv is a stand-up club.
Okay.
Yeah.
It's not like a job,
yes,
right?
But I still perform there sometimes. Okay. Yeah. But I feel like I used to be there more. And then the Comedy Store, which I feel like every TV show now like has a comedian at the Comedy Store. Sex and the City, or and Just Like That. Did Che Diaz, did you watch it?
Yeah, of course.
Did you see the new
episode? No, I didn't. Okay. I just saw the clip of Rosie singing Wicked, which I, of course, love.
Oh, okay.
Because I love Wicked.
Oh, you do?
And I love Rosie.
I haven't seen Wicked yet.
What is the cliche you would think like about, if you think about like German art, German theater?
Yeah, I guess more serious, but I do feel like Berlin seems exciting. Like to go and see...
Yes.
Art in Berlin seems like it would be exhilarating. It's something I've been wanting to do.
Yeah, you should do. It is all that, but it's not funny.
Mm.
There are maybe some.
I kind of picture like a leather jacket. This is honestly what I picture. Yeah, and maybe it's like in the 80s or something. I do picture being kind of like, yeah, like kind of how the New York subways were in the 80s, like... I picture like a leather jacket and then like a painting that has like a hot pink like smear and like neon and kind of people who are kind of dressed punk and then with really vibrant paintings.
Ah, interesting.
Is that's how I see Berlin.
Yeah.
No.
Everything, yes, just not the vibrant paintings.
Interesting.
Paintings are maybe like gray, brown.
Oh.
Gray, concrete.
Wow.
I don't know. Maybe I'm also, that's cliche.
Well, should I move to Berlin?
Yeah, or you should.
Can I get a Thomas Mann?
Resident, yeah, yeah. You can move over to Pacific Palisades then. They don't. Yeah.
I did perform over there a couple months ago. I performed at the Mensa convention. Do you know Mensa? It's.
Of course, yes. How high are you up there?
I don't know that I am Mensa. I've never taken the test.
You just pretended to be.
Well, they just asked me to do it.
Okay.
I performed at their convention. So I was like their entertainment.
Mm-hmm. And how did that go?
It was so fun. I've done it 2 years in a row, actually. And the year before, I felt like, I don't know if that went so good. But they asked me back. And this one was very fun. Now, this time I did mostly crowd work because I felt like they wanted to talk about themselves. Okay. They wanted me to make fun of them.
So you also do crowd work?
I do in a long set. So if I am doing an hour show, I can't sustain that energy that you saw.
Yeah.
If I were that giving of myself for an hour, everyone would be exhausted. I've got to find moments. I feel like, and sometimes I don't want to waste my time on stage interacting with the audience if it's a shorter set, you know? I just think I want to do work on my material. Mm-hmm. And then if I go out on the road or something, I do a lot of crowd work.
I don't want to talk to you. Yeah.
Well, first of all, if it's a bad audience, I don't want to ever say that. If my material's not connecting the way I would like for it to, I need to dig deeper. You know, like some people right off the bat are just like, I love these jokes. I love what you do. I just want to have this experience. By the way, I'm really patting myself on the back by saying that. So many people say, I love what you do. I love these jokes. I just mean, if I'm feeling that, then I kind of go with it. I just kind of ride the energy. But if I'm doing some of my favorite jokes and people are like, or whatever, then I have to dig in a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
And you can find really fun, surprising things, and you can end up writing on stage too.
Okay.
You know, finding moments that maybe later you could turn into something bigger. And.
But how do you navigate this? Because sometimes I find, you know, this crowd work also can be, you Americans, you can navigate this. You know, there's this fine line between being like nasty.
Yeah.
And degrading and being funny.
I mean, I've offended people. Yeah. I don't think I said anything that was offensive, but I thought, oh, I was just in the moment being silly and I missed something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like you can't as a performer absorb everything, every moment and be like, I got it moment to moment. I'm right there every show. Like,
no. Yeah.
And so I think I just misunderstood what I don't even remember what the word was, but in a situation like that, And maybe I even said on stage, like, I'm so sorry, I didn't realize that's what that was. And then because I genuinely feel that way, that I never want to be mean-spirited. I'm thrilled that anyone would come to see me. And I want it to be for everyone to enjoy. So, but the crowd work thing is interesting because a lot of comedians now are saying that they don't like that all these clips are people doing crowd work mm-hmm. because it makes people lazy comedians. And there is a little bit of truth to that in that.
Because you think you don't have the material, you just.
Yeah. And also the quality of what people put online, sometimes they'll just say like two or three sentences that don't really have, that aren't really a joke. And then the clip is over. You know how it says watch again? I'm always like,
what?
Watch what? Yeah, exactly. Like, what did I see? You know, it'll be like, oh, here are two funny lines I said. But they feel the pressure to post it because we've got to feed this machine or something. Mm-hmm. And so in a way, you know, this pressure to post has created people saying, I have to put out an hour of material every year. And instead of, you know, metaphorically speaking, baking cookies, they're putting out cookie batter. This isn't developed. It's not where it could be. And I've seen it. I saw it happen to someone. I'm acting like it's some huge tragedy, but I saw it happen to someone I know where I thought, oh, I feel like they used to write jokes and craft. And now it's just spitting out ideas kind of, mm-hmm. or what do you guys want to talk about? And you know, if that's your gift, the other side of it is if that's your strength, you should be able to share that if that's what you want to do on stage. Absolutely. But it's definitely changed things. I feel like crowd work is kind of part of it. There's no fourth wall. Mm-hmm. So even if you are a comedian who says, I'm not going to do any crowd work, someone's going to say something or go, me too, or something from the audience. And you can choose to just not respond, but then you kind of look like you're in a play.
Mm-hmm. And Americans love to respond, love to shout. They love to shout mm-hmm. and interact. You know, the Germans are much more
well
convinced, even yes. funny. And the Americans are, yeah, yeah.
I'm ready.
Yeah, I'm ready. Right. And the Americans are really like, you know, yes. shouting and saying yes and whatever. And they are yes. into it from minute one.
I wish they were shouting yes. Yeah, no. Keep going. Yeah, keep You're going. Brilliant.
Yeah, no. Energetically.
Yeah, exactly.
But yeah, you have to react then or some kind. Yeah.
Yes.
Otherwise, it's like a check off.
So people are upset that people are doing crowd work because they think it also encourages the audience because they're used to seeing it on Instagram and TikTok. So they think, oh, I'm supposed to go to a comedy show and yell. I'm involved. And I don't know to what degree I think that's true because I feel like it was always like that. People saying, oh, I don't want to sit in the front row because I'm going to get talked to.
I didn't want to see in the front. Yeah. When I went to Dynasty Typewriter, yes. the guy who was the usher or something,
yeah.
he had a really hard time finding people for the first row. And he was like, you get a free popcorn if you get into the first
really?
Row. And I'm like, I'm German. I'm not going into the first row. I don't want to be talked to. I'm
the so first
afraid.
Row.
Yeah. I'm so afraid. But that's also maybe because all of the clips of the crowd yeah. work, you think like,
oh, they so will. You do think that, yeah.
Yes. So you think like...
No, did people do it that night? Was there crowd work?
No.
No. Wait, that was not. Did Otsko do any? I don't think she did.
No. No.
No, Pat Regan doesn't really do
no,
that.
They did.
How funny is Pat they, Regan? Do you remember Pat with the
I
joke
love
about...
I to talk to him. I wrote to him, but he didn't
Oh, really?
Him. Yes.
They were all hilarious.
Yes, they were.